This is Tim McHenry, producer of the Rubin Museum of Art, and you are listening to the Red Book Dialogues on WNYC's Talk to Me series.
Okay, the way this goes, I've been told, is that John has not seen this image at all. He's been very careful. Apart from we've had a little look around down there. And so this is the first time John has seen this image, and I believe it's going to be shown as I open this screened behind us up there. So here we are, John. It's page 119, and that is it.
That's up there now, is it?
Yes, it's there now. Everyone can see it. They're all whispering.
Yes.
What's the first thing that comes to mind?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that it's a familiar image of the serpent, but it's got all these legs. Instead of whereas a snake, a serpent shouldn't have legs. There was it's very interesting. You know, I live in Ireland. And the legend that St. Patrick cast out the snakes from Ireland. There are no snakes in Ireland. He cast them out. And Brendan Behan said, well, they swam across the Atlantic and turned into Irish cops in New York. there's an island off the coast of Kerry, Skellig, which is a rock which juts up out of the sea, and on top of it was a little monastery where these monks would live in very difficult conditions, and they lived in these sort of beehive huts back in the 6th century. And they were raided by Vikings. And it always bothered me. I thought, well, you know, these monks living, clinging to the rocks and living in a state of poverty and exaltation because they were close to heaven. What could the Vikings expect to find there? I mean, what treasures would they have that to be pillaged? And when I was there on one occasion, they close it off for a bit because it's very dangerous. There are these vertiginous steps that are cut out of the rock that you have to climb up to get to the top, and people kept falling into the sea. And I was up there. It was closed, but it was open. You could, with some influence, you could get it out. And there was an archaeologist working, and below the Christian level, there are other foundations of other buildings. And when I tell you that, at the peak, the mountain is no bigger than the stage. And on it were three or four of these huts. And the archaeologist found a serpent carved into the rock. So it struck me that probably St. Patrick cast out not the snakes, but the snake worshippers. And that image of the serpent, the snake, which you find in so many cultures, is pre-Christian. And that's it occurs in many, many forms. And this particular image, which is that the serpent, it seems to be in distress. It's upside down. It's turning in on itself. And I think the snake is very, very important. I mean, when I made this film Excalibur, I saw myself as one of a line of storytellers who retell this same story from time to time, and generation to generation. And I mean, you could say, the definition of a myth is a story that keeps being retold. something that has such inherent strength that it can be twisted and turned and altered in all kinds of ways and still...
Was there some way in which Excalibur, you consciously or maybe unconsciously, were, like Emerald Forest is pretty obviously quite inspirational in terms of ecological studies and concerns like that. Was Excalibur carrying that same concern, even though it was in a very mythical form and it was about what it was about, a story told many times before? What were you aware of? Because you did film it in and around where you live in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you were very much in touch with something about the context of that movie.
Well, yes, and I think the just to finish on that thing, because so what I was gonna, probably what the Viking, why they raided this place was probably because it was a sacred place to them and to pre-Christian. So, and of course, the Christians were great plagiarists. They took on every holy site and made it their own. And of course, my approach to Excalibur was that it's very difficult for me to decide at what point to pitch it, because I decided to pitch it at the point when Christianity was taking over from the old religion. So that it was right on the cusp. And that Merlin, as he said, the old gods are gone and it's time for the one God. And you can't escape often people make a mistake when they tell the story, particularly they think of, they tell the story of who King Arthur really was. It's absolutely boring and uninteresting, because it's the myth that's important, not the what he may have been, a chieftain of some kind. And so you have to acknowledge what people know about the story already. And one of the interesting things about most myths is that if you ask somebody, depending on the culture, of course, but if you ask someone in England when they first read about or knew about King Arthur and the Grail legend, most people can't tell you. It's as though they've always known it. These myths, I think, are probably... Jung, would you agree, Carl? They're inside us, and when we tell the story, what we're doing is revealing stories that are already in people's minds.
But you had wanted to make Lord of the Rings, hadn't you? And that was something that was on and off and on and off. And in the end, you were so glad you could make Excalibur. And they have something in common about the relation of us to the earth and us to nature, which goes throughout all your movies, isn't it?
It is. And I think, and Tolkien, of course, was immersed in not only the Grail legend, but all the Norse legends too. And he was, I think one of the great things he did once a year is he recited Beowulf in the original language.
Mm.
From memory,
in the mood, was it?
From memory. So and of course he wrote that book at the time of the First World War, really, when it was reacting to the First World War, to the destruction of the First World
War. When Jung was writing this stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, so behind the snake is a kind of column, and there's a figure caught inside it, and it seems to be a kind of jester figure.
Well, he's wielding a sword.
Yes. The interesting thing about the sword, of course, is that this is the central image of Excalibur, which is the sword rising from the lake, held in the hand of a woman with the Lady of the Lake. And this I put a lot of effort into making this shot, because it was, I wanted to it to seem, it could have a magical feeling to it, a mythical feeling. And so I put a structure under the water, and this and the sword was a charge of dynamite, which shot the sword up at tremendous speed. And then I filmed it with a camera that was running at 175 frames per second, as opposed to 24 frames per second. So that the sword came out very fast, and the camera slowed it down. So you had that that sense that it was somehow impossible. It wasn't within our optical compass. And of course, so what does that represent? For me, the sword represented the focusing of the unconscious. And in the beginning of the film, there's a kind of chaos at the time of Uther Pendragon. There's chaos and destruction. And the sword, through the intermediary of Merlin, the sword is given. And he conjures it from the lake. And I saw that as a focusing of the unconscious, of the forces of the unconscious being focused in this power. And that's also an image which you find in other... The magical sword is you find in all sorts of myths.
It's very much an image of great creativity as well as great destructiveness, that sword,
yeah,
isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because it is violent and it is used to fight, and when it's not used with the right respect, that's when the trouble happens and it breaks, and then Merlin has to intervene. And so it's a very sort of ambiguous or to be respected type of tool of humanity. That's how it seems to go through it.
Yes, and I think this idea of the sword, this of a magical sword, you find in other... I mean, for instance, in the Chanson de Roland, you have the sword which is forged with four nails from the cross. Mm. And it's able to slice people right down the middle, which is quite interesting. So, yes, it's... So here in this image, we have a man wielding a sword, caught up in a kind of labyrinth, and he seems to be slaying this. Do you get that feeling?
He's
slaying
and dismembering
this monster.
It. Yeah. Hmm? And dismembering it.
Yeah. Yes. So cutting these arms or feet off. So is that does that suggest that this monster, is if you cut off those limbs, it becomes an ordinary serpent?
In a way, for me, it's also about this struggle that you depict in Excalibur, the way you put that Arthur story together, between the relationship between Merlin and the destiny of the country and the destiny of the king, as though there is always this serpent, sorcerer, conjurer. And this image here is of something that Jung called Atma Victu, who is a sort of serpent conjurer, who is being dealt with by this young man, a sort of heroic young man, and who he's bringing it down. And it's about a matter of when certain aspects of spirit become not useful, they have to be cut back and taken down to make way for the next thing that's going to happen. And I remember Merlin actually does retire at a certain point. And it's this delicate relationship between letting things be and letting nature go on, and how much control and the relationship of our control and our respect for nature as it goes on, the way we push forward and pull back. And I think that's been very much a concern of several of the things you've made.
Yeah.
And maybe that's a concern, in yourself. How much do you let happen? How much do you take charge of as a director or whatever? And how much do you let happen and respect happening and just wonder at it?
Well, I think the there are many aspects of that myth, and the Merlin character. I cast Nicole Williamson to play this part. I don't know if any of you remember the film, but there was. I made it for the film for United Artists, and they had made four or five films with Nicole Williamson, and they'd all bombed. And when I said I wanted to cast Nicole as Merlin, they said, look, cast anyone in the world you want, but not Nicole Williamson. So I tried to think of someone that I couldn't. He was so strong in my mind as this character because of this element of craziness, and that he was silly and at the same time clever and wise, and all the aspects of Merlin. And I tried to find someone else that I just couldn't. And so in the end, I decided to cast him. In spite of my bosses, and they just had to swallow it. And I was having lunch with Mary Selway, who was the casting director, and I said, Mary, I'm going to cast Nicole. And at that moment, he walked into the restaurant, quite by accident. And he came over, and she said, Nicole, John is going to cast you. He said, now who's playing Morgana? So I said, Helen Mirren. And he said, in that case, I can't do it. Why not? Well, we did the Scottish play together, and, she wanted me to fuck her, and I wouldn't. So I went to Helen. And I said, how do you feel about Nicole? She said, is Nicole going to play Merlin? I said, yeah. She said, I couldn't possibly do it. Why not? Well, we did the Scottish play together, and he wanted to fuck me, and I wouldn't. So I cast them both. And the antagonism worked for the film. But he was, I saw him doing Hamlet at the Roundhouse in London, and that was the moment when I wanted him to play the part. He, this diction, which I always remember. He, the most spiteful Hamlet you ever saw. Oh, most wicked haste, to post with such dexterity to incestuous sheets. And he always managed to insert an extra vowel into every word. But he was the archetype of the magician trickster. Mm. Part fake and part real. And So it was the very foundation of the film for me.
Have you identified with any of these the characters in any particular way? I haven't picked up that you have. That's one thing that I haven't particularly noticed, that you are more of a, much more of a someone on the outside rather than being in and expressing or having something carried for you through any of the characters. It is more the whole scope of each piece that carries you. How would you say your personal relationship with this material that you've put before us is?
Well,
where are you?
I suppose I made a film called Hope and Glory, which is about my childhood.
Well, yeah.
So that was very much about my surrogate, me. In terms of how I felt about the Arthurian myth, for instance, is that I feel I'm in the midst of it.
Mm.
I feel I'm. I feel I live in the midst of it. It's in spiritual psychological terms. I inhabit it, and not in any particular one character or another, but somehow, after all those character aspects of oneself. So it's part of I don't know. I remember a couple of years after I made the film, this Chinese American came on a bicycle to my house in Ireland, and he rode up and he said he knew every frame of the film, and he wanted would I tell him where I'd shot various scenes. He wanted to visit these scenes. He wanted to pay homage to the places. So I told him, and I said, "Would you like to see Excalibur?" He said, "Could I?" I said, "Yeah, I've got it indoors." So I went out and got Excalibur. I brought it out, and I took it out of its sheath, and I said, "There it is." And so he fell to his knees. I said, "Will you get up?" And I said, "Would you like to hold it?" He said, "No." I said, "Go on, hold it." He said, "No, I couldn't hold it." I said, "Go, just try it." So he reached out his hands and he held it like this, and his eyes were flashing with inspiration. And so, and then I said, "Would you like to see the Holy Grail?" I said, "Everyone thinks it's lost, but actually it's not. It's not standing on my piano." He couldn't face that. He ran off. So I love the way that when these things, these artifacts, touch real life.
But that's what you wanted about the film. You said it was very important that this Arthur story was about this material thing, this sword, and the very material things we were talking about earlier, of the difference between writing and imagining and actually getting your hands on something, which is the production process. Mm. And what's your relationship between that? Where are you happiest, or do you love to move between the two, the material stuff and or the idea stuff or the visual stuff? You know, like Jung did, move between making to drawing.
Yeah, I think that's probably... the words, in the end, are limited, aren't they? Their words can do wonderful things, but they're limited. And I think that's what you were saying, wasn't it, that Jung needed to express some of his thoughts in images. And movie making is interesting because it starts off with words. You write a script, and you work on it, and you write it in such a way to suggest images. And then the next process is really to convert it into images. And but the solitary work of the script then becomes the corporate work of making, of shooting the film. And that's collaborative actors and technicians and making these images. And I find the more you prepare, more carefully you prepare the shots that you're going to do, the more open you are to inspiration of the moment. And that's when things really happen, is that it's that it's turning a scene into cinema. There's always one thing, there's always one extra element that makes makes a scene into cinema, whatever it is. It can come from anywhere. And it usually, in my experience, happens when you're at some extremity. You know that writers often say that when they're really working at their height is they feel they're taking dictation. And somehow, if you have complete control over the process of shooting a film, and you have, and you're in command, you know exactly everything, every element, and that's when you are open to inspiration, to spontaneity, and you can include it into your plan. So it's preparing yourself in such a way as you can be open to this strange thing that happens when you are working at your extremities.
When Jung was doing this, cinema was, of course, in its infancy. But I think he appreciated something about cinema, how it actually gave opportunities for people to participate in things and experience things in great safety, away from the actual events themselves, but actually get some shared sense of definitely the emotion and often the psychological experience.
Mm. Yes.
I imagine, you know, we'd say that's similar these days. But how do you feel that the cinema fits with the modern psyche, you know, at the beginning of the 21st century?
Well, of course, when, you know, cinema occurred, I mean, the first films were made by the Lumiere brothers just at the end of the century, and film being a 19th century invention. And it was, of course, black and white. And we know how people reacted to train coming towards them. They ducked under the seats. And you know, within a matter of a very few years, I mean, by 1914, when Griffith and his cameraman Billy Bitzer had really invented the grammar of the cinema, the close-up, the reverse shots, wide shots, moving camera, all the grammar of film. And, you know, Charlie Chaplin, when he 2 years after he arrived in Hollywood, he was the most famous man in the world and one of the richest. I mean, the film absolutely swept the world. And I think the reason was that it was, first of all, it was in black and white, and most people dream in black and white. The watching film was very close to the process of dreaming, and still is. D.H. Lawrence describes in his book, in his novel, The Lost Girl, her father had this little theater, and they had a mixture of live acts and these short films, 10-minute films, that were coming up at that time. And Lawrence said that when these miners were watching the live acts, they looked at the corner of their eye, and there was a kind of air of embarrassment about watching these people on the stage. And when the films came on, then they seemed to go into a kind of trance. Their eyes stared, and their mouths dropped. And this trance-like feeling, watching a film. You know, we all know that sensation of when you see a really good film and you actually, it severs your moorings and you float into the film. And this, and the fact that when I was researching for the Emerald Forest, I lived with a tribe in the Xingu part of the Amazon, which was an area that was only discovered by the outside world in 1947. So that up until that time, they believed that there was nothing else in the world except these few tribes living in this area. And when I tried to explain to Takuma, who was the shaman of this tribe, what I did, what a film was, it's rather difficult. If you're trying to explain to somebody who's never seen a film or watched a television, it's rather difficult to explain. And so I tried to say, well, you know, it's possible to move from one place to another place, to be behind someone and then be in front of them. And he said, well, you're describing what happens in trance and in dream. And so that closeness of dream to the act of watching cinema is very close. And I think it's had a huge influence. Now, once you introduced, of course, sound and color, it became less connected to dream than it had been. So little by little, it's got both closer to reality and further away.
You've touched on something there in that, you know, he's pointing out, or you're pointing out the similarities, because there is a need for us not to be just living a conscious, directed, more or less rational, practical existence. There is a, as Jung said, you know, fantasy thinking, much maligned and downplayed in modern times, is something we absolutely need to enrich us. And paying attention to our dreams is one way of doing that. Fantasizing and able to have time out like that, whether it's through taking some substance or actually getting lost in a movie and the world of that, to help our fantasizing, it's nutritious for the psyche and for the soul. It's an absolute necessity. Would you say that people are aware of that and need that, and that still draws them to the cinema and other forms of storytelling like that?
Yes, and I think that I think there are dream films. I mean, most films somehow traduce the possibilities. I mean, the possibilities
become too real.
The trance-like, dream-like qualities of film have been trampled on rather by the way they've been colonized by the bad guys. It's a pity, you know, I always regretted that Jung didn't write more about the Grail legend, but it was his wife's field, wasn't it, Emma. And when her book finally came out, it was very disappointing. But that's why he kept away from it, because it was her province. But he had those dreams quite often, several dreams about her. He had that dream that all the knights were sleeping and the Grail had to be returned to the Grail castle. And how was it going to be done when everyone was asleep? And he had another dream. I can't remember what it was exactly, but it was in Cornwall, and it was also to do with Arthur.
Have you ever dreamt your stories or scenes before you've shot them? Have you ever sort of got something as direct as that? That's out of fantasy.
Oddly say that because when I'm shooting a film, I mean, by that time, of course, I've immersed myself in it and its imagery and so forth. So, but when I every night when I go to sleep, I run the film through in my head, and I run through scenes that have been shot and also scenes that haven't been shot. And sometimes, and as I'm running the film in my head, I come to a scene that I haven't quite worked out. And I pass over it, and I go on to the next one. And then I wake up in the morning and I remember a dream. I dreamt that scene, the missing scene, cut for cut. And I write it down, and so that relationship happens.
Just thinking again about this picture, it does show someone struggling manfully or boyfully with this serpent, which could really totally overcome him. And when I've read about some of the movie making you've done and where you've taken yourself and the problems you've given yourself and your actors and the crew to actually make the work, it's almost as if you sometimes have really enjoyed putting yourself up against it. And it's the it is often nature in all its forms. And allowed something to come from that without making it easy for yourself at all. And I wonder where that comes from in you, why you seek to do that. From deliverance
to deliverance.
Well,
I think we live, you know, we all live rather comfortable lives and we don't know what our limits are. And when I take a crew and cast into a very tough situation like a raging river or a Amazon forest or something, that I always feel that if I push myself and others to the limits, I can exceed those limits. I can actually... And crew and cast always complain bitterly about the discomforts. But fundamentally, they want to do that. They all want to find those limits. They all want to feel, see if they can actually exceed their limits. And it's there, it's in those situations of extremity that some kind of truth emerges.
That's exactly what Jung says on page 8. If no outer adventure happens to you, then no inner adventure happens either. In this way, you'll find your lower as well as your upper limit, and if you do not know them, you'll run into the artificial barriers of your imagination and the expectations of your fellow men. And these barriers are not real barriers. They're not real limits. It's only by putting yourself in that outer adventure situation, I think you're saying you...
It's fascinating. Well, that is the case, and I think that's why people love being involved in a movie because it's like war, and every time you make a movie, you've lost a war because it's never quite what you expected and wanted to be.
Yeah. going back to the relationship between cinema and ourselves these days, what do you think needs to be said in that form? Is it at all... I mean, does it take us away, take people away from actually self-exploring, or is that just for another activity? Or is there a way... people can get it inspired into their own fantasizing and their own imaginations through movies themselves, which, you know, had they not seen the movie, I think someone talked to you in the lobby about this, had they not seen the movie, perhaps their lives would have gone a different direction. Mm. But it goes into them and it sort of links in with their own fantasizing and their own potential, because movies, especially popular movies, must be popular because they're expressing something collective.
Yes.
In the soul of all of those who watch them and enjoy them.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's why I think it's quite different to watch a movie in a movie theatre rather than watching it at home on a TV.
What's the difference for you? What do you find?
Well, it's a collective experience. Mm. And I think it's the you're touching on the collective unconscious. And the watching... I mean, Scott Fitzgerald... I mean, there's a counter to that, because Scott Fitzgerald said that the movies of taking away our dreams, of all betrayals, is the worst.
Yeah.
In the sense that, you know, we've done everything and seen everything and experienced everything at second hand, making love in all kinds of ways, being killed but in different ways. Everything, we've been to every part of the world, so that we're second-hand people, in a sense. On the other hand, we are enriched by it also, by having those experiences, and that as you say, it does nourish. They nourish our inner worlds, and most films, of course, are bad, and it's only very occasional ones that are good. And yet we're impelled to go and see it. However many times we're disappointed, we're impelled to go back and try again. It's almost as though we're looking for the kind of ultimate movie that hasn't yet been made, And we're hoping that the next one might be it, as the lights go down. Mm. You always feel that I do, the sense of excitement, that maybe this is it, this is the one.
Jung says the unconscious makes itself known most vividly through projection, by projecting itself outside onto others and other things in the world. And of course, I think that happens in movies. And the movie makers are projecting their psyches into their story.
Yes.
And then somehow the audience do the same thing. And then a third thing happens between the stories, yes, the minds, and so on. Have you experienced something like that? Are you aware of that?
Yes, I think that, all life is metaphor, in a sense, that, and we're searching the outside world for something that's going to coincide with our inner landscape. I think that's something that we touch on. If there's an artist, a painter, or a filmmaker, whatever, who appeals to us, it's because it connects to something within us. And I think that's what Jung was concerned to do with these pictures. He was trying to express something that couldn't be expressed in words. Presumably he dreamt all the... Are these all dreams that he had, or are they just...
What he calls an active imagination, which is halfway between dreaming and just plain daydreaming and fantasy thinking, in that, he let himself go down sufficiently out of a conscious state, but not so much that he was out of control of his dreaming mind, so he could actually engage with and have conversations with the characters in his fantasies.
Yes.
Which is... it's quite an acquired skill, I think, and not for everyone. But it means he was actually there with his fantasizing and retaining a conscious reflection on it. Because he said images are flowing through us all the time, and they're not one use to us unless we actually watch what's happening and consciously reflect on it. And I think that's what you seem to be saying about what artists and filmmakers can bring before us.
Well, to go back for a moment to the Chingu, when I was living with this tribe, and at first I thought it was so incredibly boring because nothing happened.
Yeah.
And people didn't speak during the day. Not that I could understand Tupi, but they just... women did their work and the men went out, in this case, mostly fishing. And it was so repetitive. I thought I'd go mad. But I realized quickly that, in fact, everything happened at night. And the day was something to get through. You had to get your food and you had to hunt and you had to do your chores. And then the theater started at night. And what would happen is that the men would sit around the fire, and then someone would start a little chant going, a rhythmic beating on the soil with a foot. And he would just go, and then sometimes it would just sort of peter out, and other times others would join in, and the chanting got more and more strong, more and more people joined in, and eventually the shaman would appear. And he would eventually... The hallucinogenic they used in this particular tribe was actually tobacco, which a wild tobacco made into a cheroot, which he would hyperventilate on. Usually throw up. But it was only... Often he didn't need the tobacco. The rhythmic chanting was enough. And then they entered into this other world. And it was extraordinary. I mean, first of all, I couldn't take part in this until I had discovered which was my animal familiar. Once that was sketched, I could take part in it. And then they sawed off into their into their movie. And they joined up with the ancestors, they traveled, they moved around. It was extraordinary. And this richness of this life that they enjoyed. And the strange thing was then that we all lived in these huge kind of domed huts on hammocks. And I had a very vivid dream one night, and I recounted it. And they said, "Oh yeah, we had that dream." And this to them was very commonplace, that they would share the same dream. So there was this nightlife that was going on continuously. And it's something, clearly, it's an ability that we've lost, or only fragmentarily are able to experience. Sometimes we remember a dream, we don't, or it's fragmented, or it doesn't come together. And then you have Jung trying to interpret them. And he did say, I remember the end of Memories, Dreams, that he described how he was, as he got older, into his last years, how he was getting closer to nature and closer connecting to the natural world, which he lost, or he hadn't been able to achieve it. And it was coming, as he got to his last years, it was coming closer to him, which I feel is happening to me. Mm. I spend much of my time investigating the alternative intelligence of trees. And some remarkable discoveries, which I won't go into now, it's off the subject, but...
I don't know if you realise this, John, but there's something else you have in common with this bird that has appeared a couple of times in your life and has been very significant in terms of your relationship and your feel for nature. When you were a kid, you were lent a gun or were out with a gun which was owned by the son of your mother's lover, which was...
How do you remember all this?
His name was Peter.
That's right.
And you were so excited with this gun, and you were shooting fish, and
more than that. It was when I was a child, yeah. And living on the Thames, and it was during the war, just after, and I had this sense. I mean, I had this great epiphany at one point, because I went to a Catholic school, and my parents were Protestant. On Sundays, I was a choir boy at the Protestant church, and during the week, I was in a Catholic school, and I was terribly troubled by this, because they both claimed to be the true church, and it bothered me, because I realized that both couldn't be right. And one day I was on the river, my boat. It was a beautiful day, and I was just going, drifting under these weeping willows, and suddenly I thought, there's another alternative. You know, one of them has to be right and one of them has to be wrong. And the other alternative is, how about if they're both wrong? And I was 12 years old, and I had this, I levitated, you know. I this great weight was lifted from me, and I was lightness. And I was completely at one with the river and nature. I was completely... whole. And then my friend Pete came in with a BB gun, and from having this wide vision, suddenly everything was focused down to this one point where you shoot these fish. Yeah. And this and so suddenly there was this flash, and it was a kingfisher, and I took the gun up and fired. And it was impossible, because kingfisher moves so fast, and it's this kind of movement. And I hit it, and it fell into the river. And and it fluttered, and I got it out, but it died. And I felt that I'd committed this sin against nature, the kingfisher, the fisher king, and that I could, it was unforgivable. And years later, my home in Ireland, I was working alone in the house, and suddenly I had this bang, and a kingfisher had been chased by a hawk, and it hit the window, and it fell and broke its neck, and I died. So I had it stuffed and put in a little glass case, and I have it in my house, and I have it there to remind me of the way that I'd sinned. And so I think what I'm doing in my life now is really trying to expiate that sin by serving my trees. And
were you aware of Jung's kingfisher experience, where he dreamed of the kingfisher?
No.
And then found one dead, I hope it wasn't yours, by the shores of the lake. Very rare in the Swiss lakes, a kingfisher. And he's included that in some of the drawings.
I didn't know that.
Yes. That's a little thread that goes right through these kingfisher stories, yeah. I'd like to thank John Borman for coming here to the Reuben Museum.